Okay, shall we begin? Shall we begin? So we have had four lectures in this series on human factors. The first two had to do with sort of form follows function, and then kind of function follows form. What's the relationship between the physical environment and our behavior or our activities or how we do those. Then we had two lectures on humanism, one of them having to do with humanism at a small scale, an intimate scale of our bodies in interaction with rooms and furniture and doorknobs and things at that scale. And then last time looking at humanism at the scale of a larger community or neighborhood or city, and talking about the impact that has on how we live and our self-realization through reason, those things implicit in humanism. And last time we talked about eight different ways that we maybe make more humane environments at this larger scale. And then the Twitter card question was for you to tell me, how important is this to me? If I'm looking for a place to spend my life, is this going to be an important factor I'm looking for, or is it not important? And I got to say on these Twitter card responses, maybe I'm doing this as a way of helping you think deeper about the subject matter. But maybe I'm doing this just because it's such a gas to read these things for me. And this is totally for my own gratification, just getting a good laugh or getting a good provoking thought or whatever. Anyway, I really, really enjoy reading them. I've got an extra large number I'm going to read to you today because there were such kind of cool responses. So for a whole lot of people, this was important. This was a large factor for them in how they might choose what city they lived in or what neighborhood and so on. So here are some selections. Somebody says, humanism is for me the most important topic we've discussed to date. The quality of how I live my life in the future should be solely dependent on the ease, community, and sense of comfort. Somebody else says, humanism will be extremely important, if not the most important thing that I will consider. I come from a small town where there isn't much to do, and I don't even know most of my neighbors. All I wanted was to get out of that town, so I wouldn't want to be somewhere like that again. Someone else says, humanism will be vitally important to me when I choose a place to live. I want to live in a pedestrian-oriented city that is vibrant and diverse, has many signs of human presence, affords me many choices of activities, and also has natural relief. Sprawling, car-oriented, cookie-cutter suburbs do not interest me. Lively streets and a sense of place does. Somebody else says, humanism will be the most important factor for me. I want to live in a vibrant place that will offer a variety of activities. Austin is a great example of humanism at the scale of a city. And after living here and experiencing the effect, I know humanism will be the most important factor to decide where I live. Someone else says, notions of humanism will be the first consideration when determining where I want to live. Growing up in the suburbs, I'm tired of being in a place where everything is the same, the buildings and the people. A humanistic environment is a huge part of living a full life and enjoying it fully. Somebody else says, I come from the heart of suburbia, and it lacks nearly all of the humanistic considerations we touched on. Now contrast that with a city like Austin, where I have the pleasure to live now, and the difference is really dramatic. Just day to day, even the simplest things, I'm happier. I love it. Somebody else says, humanism is the most important thing. Living in an urban environment that is energetic and promotes interaction and movement is essential to me. Throughout this lecture, I was informed about why I love cities like Austin and San Francisco so much. Someone else says, humanism is going to be a huge factor in where I live. I want constant entertainment and the feeling of walking to a great restaurant with my family for dinner. I want my kids to have a great place to play and to be able to walk in the park or fish or play football. And I want a place where my work isn't a long commute. Somebody else says, aspects of humanism will be one of the most important factors in deciding where I live. I want my environment to motivate me to explore and to go outside my comfort zone. I want to live in a place that is alive and welcoming and humane. Finally, on the pro side, someone says, shit. Let's be completely honest here. This is perhaps the most important thing. The fact that Austin is such a humanist city is a huge pull for the university and lots of businesses. Like, what am I going to do in College Station for fun? Eat Chipotle and watch the trees grow? Every day? Probably. Then there were some people who did not think humanism was so important. Someone says, humanism is for me the most... There were some who did not feel strongly about humanism. Someone says, I like to live in a quiet community. It's okay if there isn't super convenience or lots of activities, as long as there's a way to get groceries. Someone else says, I don't foresee humanism being a huge factor in my future residence. I plan on settling in a relatively desolate countryside and being self-sufficient. That's cool. Hey, it's not for everyone. Someone else says, I will live in Houston, Texas, because the oil and gas industry is there. Therefore, the vibrancy of the city is not important to me. Whatever. I want to emphasize again, I think that's real and that's important. Not everyone is going to see the benefits of one aspect of the physical environment the same as everybody else. It's meant to be different. And I think it's fantastic that someone says, I do not want to live in a city where there's all this interaction and activity and stimulation and provocation. I want to freaking be private. And that's cool. And there are physical environments that reinforce that quality of life. And it's important to know that about yourself and to seek that out. That's absolutely cool. And then there are other people that would drive them freaking nuts. And that's cool too. So today, we're looking at human factors in quite a different way than we have before. We're looking at how buildings convey meaning, how buildings communicate. And that means communicating to ourselves within a single culture, or how do buildings over time communicate what the interests or the values or the character of that of another culture were, or messages that culture might want to convey. Now, we use visual things to communicate all the time. All the time. And maybe we do it more now than we ever have in the past. But all of you make decisions about what you wear, and it communicates something, whether you intend it to or not. If you wear an orange sweatshirt to class every day with a big old longhorn on it, it definitely says something about you. Says something about where you go to school, what kind of loyalties you have, maybe a little bit about your sartorial sophistication. It says something. And people read it and we understand it. If someone came into this class, as I have had students do, and wore a coat and tie every single day of class all semester, you would get a certain message from that person who wore that coat and tie. If a woman came in and wore a skirt, a really nice sort of tailored, handsome skirt, silk blouse, every single day to class, you would get a message from that. Everything in our visual environment communicates messages. In fact, if someone wore Santa Claus hats into class someday, that also would convey a message about holiday cheer, or it's not even freaking Thanksgiving yet, or whatever. But, you know, it's a way of communicating a message. We do it all the time. And if you're a big corporation, you pay a lot of attention to the visual communication of messages. So I was one time at a Frank Lloyd Wright building in Racine, Wisconsin. It's the headquarters for Johnson Wax Company. And I'm there to see the building. But the guy who's showing me around says, oh man, there's a really important meeting going on in that conference room. But I'd like for you to see that conference room because it's one of the coolest spaces in the whole place. So we're just going to sneak into that meeting for a minute and you can look at the conference room and then we'll sneak back out. And so I go into this meeting and what they're doing is trying to decide what the pledge can looks like. You know the stuff you spray to dust? Okay, they've got 20 versions of a pledge can sitting in the middle of a conference table. They have 15 high-level executives sitting around that table discussing, should that be a little darker green? Should that be a little lighter pink? Should that word smells great be bigger or smaller? All of those little nuances. I'm freaking thinking, I go by the grocery shelf, there's like pledged. I mean, is it really that big a deal? Am I staring there thinking, was that the right shade of green? You know, no. But is that important to them? You bet it's important to them. And they know that you get an impression of their product. Not consciously, but unconsciously, you get an impression of their product from what that freaking can looks like. That's the only way they have of describing to you what this product is, what that vessel looks like that it's in. There's a wonderful book by Malcolm Gladwell called Blink. Anybody read Blink? A few of you. Great book. In it, there's a chapter on the kind of blink, just that moment impression we get from things visually, and how powerful that is in our decision making. And so he takes a number of different products that, you know, some little thing they did with the visual representation of their product either made or break the entire company. And one example was when they first invented margarine in like the 1940s, and they were trying to sell it as a replacement for butter. Now, there is no earthly reason why anyone needs a replacement for butter. Margarine is not better than butter. But somebody came up with this thing and they said, okay, we're going to replace butter. And they try to sell it and they try to sell it and they try to sell it and nobody's buying. Nobody is buying. And then one company comes along and they call their product Imperial Margarine. And they put it in a box that is bright, shiny gold. And they put a crown on the box for Imperial Margarine. This is better. This is superior. This makes you a freaking prince if you eat this stuff instead of that crappy old butter thing. And suddenly, margarine got interesting to people because it looked elegant. It looked royal. It made me feel special if I'm having that instead of butter. And the entire country became interested in margarine because that box looked so cool-ass elegant, and people started eating margarine. There's another story in there about a brandy, two different brands of brandy. One is Christian Brothers, one is E&J. Both of them kind of rot-gut brandy. But anyway, one of them is, in any taste test, far superior to the other. Everybody loved Christian Brothers way better than E&J. But E&J sold lots more than Christian Brothers. And it's because they put it in a really shapy little vessel, the bottle, and you know, put little gold shields on it and red ribbons, and it looked like, man, this is fancy brandy. And so people bought it, and they thought it tasted better. But in a blind taste test where you don't see the bottle, it loses big time. Visual communication is huge. Very important thing. And if we think it's important at the scale of a can of pledge or a box of margarine, Think how important it is at the scale of an entire building. This is something that can be a powerful thing in communicating. Now, with our very, very visual culture, where we're constantly into the internet and games and video games and all kinds of things, movies, I mean, we're an extremely visual culture, and we're really, really good at communicating with visual things and at getting visual messages from the environment around us. So today, we're going to be talking about how we use buildings as a means of communicating. And I'm going to suggest that there are really three ways that we do this. The first way is literal, direct communication. And that is you're just using an image that people understand and know and that literally is something. You're using that image to give a direct message that is about the content of that image. So an example of that might be if there's a billboard on I-35 and it says, eat more beef, and it has a picture of a big old cow there. Literally, that's a cow. That's a literal image we understand. And what we're meant to think about is a cow. It's beef. It's the meat of the cow. So it's a literal image, and it is meant to directly tell us about that thing that we're seeing. Literal direct communication. Very straightforward. A second way of communicating is literal indirect communication. Literally, we see something we understand and acknowledge, but it's meant to remind us of something else. It's meant to make us think of something else, not itself. So if you see that same billboard on I-35, and there's a big old cow up there, but it happens to be a longhorn steer, and underneath it, it says, go horns. We are not supposed to be thinking of cow. We're supposed to be thinking of UT. That is literally a cow. But we're not meant to stop there. That cow is an emblem for something else. So it's literal, indirect communication. Indirectly, we're thinking about UT through that emblem of Bevo. So literal direct communication, literal indirect communication. And the third kind of communication is abstract. And that's just where you use the quality of the space or the scale or the color or the shape or the texture. There's something in the combination of those things that makes us feel a certain thing. And that's really a powerful means of communication because we just get a nuanced message, but in an abstract way. And obviously people might get a little bit different message, different people. So if we took that imperial margarine box that was the shiny gold cardboard box and it has the big crown on it, what kind of communication is that? Well, the box itself, that shiny foil-like material is abstract communication. We associate gold with things that are fine, shiny with things that are precious. So that's abstractly the color, the texture. That's giving us a feeling of this being royal, special, important. Then that crown that's on there, that is literal indirect communication because we're meant to think crown, royalty, but we're not supposed to be thinking stopping there, but we think of luxury that's associated with crown and royalty. So now this product is given that indirect message of association with or reminder of luxury and royalty. So literal indirect communication combined with abstract communication to give us the message about that margarine. Okay, so let's begin with some slides. The first example, I don't know where my clicker went. The first example is a temple precinct in Khajuraho, India. Khajuraho is in the middle of freaking nowhere in central India, a very rural area. It's not a place very many people would visit, agricultural area. But centuries ago, between about 930 and 950 AD, this became a place where they built a whole precinct of Hindu temples. And there probably are, 60 or 70 of these individual temples now in 8 or 10 different groupings or precincts. So this was deemed to be a sacred place. And people would make pilgrimages from all over the region to come and have festivals and to have celebrations in this temple precinct. Now we look at it and it's just unbelievable the kind of wealth they had, the kind of effort they put into these temples. They're made of stone. They're very, very intricately carved. It took decades to build any one of these. It's a phenomenal amount of human energy that's put into these. And in some ways, they are just pure communication. There's not much interior to these things. They're tiny little rooms inside, but it isn't like a church where people were meant to go inside and have this gathering or ceremony. There are tiny little interiors, but basically it's about the exterior, about the message these buildings are giving. So all this effort in order to communicate certain messages. Now, I visited Khajuraho when I was in my 20s for the first time and just fell in love with the place, just thought it was one of the most amazing places I'd ever been. And then I went back a few years ago and saw it again. And the first time I went, I was being shown around by, in order to get out there, you couldn't take a train or bus or anything. There really wasn't any transportation, so we had to hire a car. And this guy drove us out there, a horrible old beat-up black, 20-year-old Ford that this guy drove us out to Khajuraho. And this guy was a total character, a local. He lived in the area, and a devout Hindu. And just to give you a sense of this guy, a big old burly guy, and he's, telling me about his family, especially his wife. And he just was so proud of his wife. He had the most amazing wife. He was so fortunate. This woman had agreed to be his wife. And so I'm saying, well, then what's so special? What is it you really love about your wife? He said, man, you won't believe this. But she can take a 50-pound vessel of water and carry it on her head from the well down below up to our village. That is a fine wife. So this is where this guy's coming from. So he's showing us around because this is where he lives. And he tells me the story of what these buildings are meant to communicate. So this is what they communicate to him. This is the story he heard, he knows, he believes. And I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just saying this is the story, this is the communication he gets. And then after that, I'm going to tell you a story that I heard the second time I was there when I visited it with a real authority on Hindu architecture who told me quite a different story about what it was meant to communicate. So this is the first story. So this driver said, a long time ago, there were very, very wealthy Hindus who lived in this region. And then there were tons and tons of poor people. Very few wealthy people, tons and tons of poor people. All the wealthy people, when they had a son, they would take the son at a young age, maybe 4 or 5 years old, and they would take the son to live with the Hindu priests. And the priests would raise the male children of the wealthy people. So they had little monasteries where they would raise these kids. And they would stay pretty much with the priests until they were 20 years old or so. And then they would go back to their family home, and the family would have arranged marriages for them. They didn't have love marriages. So, and usually the woman was much younger, maybe a 14, 15-year-old girl. So this 20-year-old guy, 14-year-old girl, they see each other first at the wedding ceremony. They're married, and, they go off to live their life. Now, the interesting thing is the
priests were celibate, so they didn't have sex. And they taught these young men that your life should be devoted to Hinduism, to your religion. You should think pure Hindu thoughts. And so sex really wasn't a part of this. And so then they get this arranged marriage with this girl who's like a little kid almost. And what was happening was there were no babies being produced. So they had these marriages. These guys were super devout Hindus who thought this was somehow not right to have sex. And then they're married to these women they barely know. And so they just were not having any babies. Now, this is a bad thing because the wealthy people were getting smaller and smaller and smaller families, while the poor people were getting more and more and more babies. So this was an imbalance in the community. And also the priests realized, wait, where does our money come from? Where does our support come from? It depends on more young males being produced in these families so we can raise them. And we don't have any young males to raise. We don't get any income. So it's a lose-lose for the families and for the priests. And they figure out they got to fix this. So they didn't want the guys to think, okay, we'll just go wild in the streets with sex. No, they wanted it somehow. They wanted them to be devout Hindus. So they had to find a way of combining sexuality and religion and making it all consistent. So they carved all these stories on these buildings. They made all these representations of life on these buildings. And part of the representation they made was about sexuality. So they made really, really hot women on these buildings. And they put them in very, very provocative poses. And this is a Hindu temple, dude. So we're not like, this is not porn, okay? This is a Hindu temple. And we're combining sexuality with religion. And it's okay to have a sexual life and still be a very, very devout Hindu. And then there are parts of them where there actually is a depiction of lovemaking acts. And, you know, this is on the Hindu temple. And very explicitly kind of describing various ways you might want to go about this. Now, this one right here, do not try this at home. Do not. But as you can see, it went beyond just procreation. It's beginning to say that there is, there's another mindset about religion. There is pleasure that can come in religion. There is love and sexuality and amour that can come from religion. And it's not inconsistent. And by putting that in the building, it's solidified to everyone that this is a part of our religion and a part of our culture. And according to my driver, it freaking solved the problem. That pretty soon the guys were like looking at, they were going to church all the time, man. They were going down those temples and studying religion. And then going home and this 14-year-old chick, hey, babe, let me show you something. So things, they had babies, is all I can say. All right, so that is one explanation. The more erudite explanation that came from the scholar of Hindu religion that showed me around the second time, and this one is really, honestly, very, very interesting and moving to me, that this guy said that Hindu religion is not like Christian religion, or not like Buddhist religion, or not like Muslim religion. Hindu religion is about life. Religion is not apart from life. Religion is life. And he said that there are four aspects of life that religion is meant to pursue. One of them is duty, which is called dharma in the Hindu religion. Another is material gain, essentially money, which is called artha. A third thing is sexuality or sexual pleasure or love,
which is called kama. And the fourth thing is salvation, that is moving to the next world or the next life, which is called nirvana. So those four things are really what human life is about. It's about duty, it's about material gain, it's about sexuality, and it's about salvation. And that all four of those things are equally important in having a fulfilling human life. And that the Hindu religion is really about all four of those things. So in your religion, of course you would depict salvation. Of course you would. Of course you would depict duty. That's morality. That's just being a good person. Of course you would depict that as part of religion. And in the Hindu religion, it's perfectly fine to depict material gain, that that was a good thing. That was seen as being a good religious person. You were successful in your job. And of course you would depict sexuality. That's just a normal part of life. How could you have a religion that really was about life without a part of that religion being sexuality? And so when you look at the temples in Khajuraho, you can see it depicting duty and depicting material gain and depicting sexuality and depicting salvation. And all of that is a part of life. So whatever reed you want to put on this, and in a certain way, my driver and this scholar are really saying the same thing, that sexuality is very much a part of life, and it can be very much a part of religion, and the kind of ethereal, spiritual feeling one gets from sexuality can also be related to the ethereal and spiritual feeling one feels in religion. These are not alien from each other. But the temples at Khajuraho depict that in an extremely powerful way. And as that, they are literal direct communication. Literally, you're looking at sexuality. What are you meant to think? You're meant to think about sexuality as an everyday part of life, parallel and a part of religion. Okay, literal direct communication. Extremely powerful way back in the 10th century and extremely powerful today as a way of communicating through buildings. Second way I described, literal indirect communication. So this is where we see something, we can understand and we can identify. It's literal, but we're actually meant to think of something else. It's meant to remind us of something. And in this case, the first example we're looking at is the University of Virginia campus in Charlottesville, Virginia. It was done between 1817 and 1825. The architect was Thomas Jefferson. Many of you probably know Thomas Jefferson's name. Very, very famous architect in the early years of America. He did many famous buildings. He did the Capitol building for the state of Virginia in Richmond. He did his own very famous house at Monticello. He did the University of Virginia campus here. He was very well schooled in architecture. He had spent years in France, traveling around, studying architecture, writing about it, learning about it. He had an incredible library. His library was full of books about architecture, beautiful folio books with drawings and depictions of architecture. He was a real scholar and erudite student of architecture. In his spare time, he also, as a hobby, wrote the Declaration of Independence and was president of the United States for 8 years. But basically, he was a phenomenal architect in the early part of the 19th century. So Thomas Jefferson, after he got through with his hobby of being president in 1808, what he dedicated the rest of his life to until he died in 1826 was building the University of Virginia campus. And he had tried, when he was president, to get Congress to make a national university. He believed that you could not have a democracy without educated people, and that, you know, university education, public education, available to anybody was absolutely essential for a democracy. So he tried to establish a national university. Congress would not go along with him and would not fund it. So when he stopped being president, he went back to Virginia and he lobbied with the Virginia legislature to see if they would support a public university for the state of Virginia. And they did do that, and he basically single-handedly established the curriculum for what a public university would be, did the architecture for that, embodied in the architecture an ethos for what public education meant, what university education meant, how that would be different from the kind of education that primarily had been done by churches, because most of the universities at that point would have been Church of England or Catholic or some kind of religious-based university. And their education would have been very much based on religious texts. So what is a secular education? What is a public education about? And this took pretty much all of his time from 1808 until 1826 when he died. He could actually sit on his porch at Monticello and he could see the site for the campus of the University of Virginia. It was relatively near his home, and he could keep a watchful eye on it. So what is Thomas Jefferson saying about what public education is in America, in the birth of this country? And he's got very strong ideas about this. So he wants to say it, and he's saying it in the architecture as explicitly as he possibly can. So he makes reference to a particular building in making the University of Virginia. And that building is the Pantheon, which we're seeing in the slide on the left. And you can tell a very, very close resemblance between the Pantheon and the University of Virginia. And I would say there are four things he's trying to tell us by using the Pantheon as an image to associate with the University of Virginia. The first thing is that he saw the Republic, in the case of the United States, parallel to the Republic that was there in Rome. They had representative government. They had a Senate. They believed in the power of the people to determine their own destiny. And this was one of the very first forms of government that employed that at all in the world, was the Senate in Roman times. And he wanted to make it very clear that this was a vehicle for democracy and for representative government, and how better to do that than to tie it back to Rome and to that great world power that was founded on this notion of being a republic. So the first thing is he's explicitly making us think Rome. And if you're a person in the 19th century and you see an image that looks like that Pantheon, which is the kind of penultimate image of Rome, you immediately think Rome and you think of the democracy and the republic that was there in Rome. A second message is that he was trying to say something about unification. The particular role of the Pantheon was very interesting. The emperor who built the Pantheon is a guy named Hadrian. Hadrian was a brilliant ruler, maybe the best of all of the Roman emperors. He'd been very successful in a military sense. He expanded the empire enormously, very popular emperor. And Hadrian was very conscientious about where Rome was going. And he observed in Roman culture this thing that bothered him. The Romans, of course, had their mythology and their gods, and that was their religion in their culture. So there would be a temple to Zeus, and there would be a whole group of people who said, "We're Zeusites. We go to the Zeus temple, and we're, you know, our god is Zeus." And then there'd be somebody else who says, no, we worship at the temple of Diana, and we're Dianaites, and we're a part of this community that's committed to Diana, the huntress. Somebody else is Venus. Somebody else is Neptune. And there were all of these temples that were growing up in Rome, and there were groups of people that were affiliating themselves with these temples, and they began to be competitive with each other. No, Zeus is better than Neptune. No, you're just like Diana. No. That's like low class compared to Zeus. There began to be this competitiveness and rivalry. And Hadrian saw that splitting the Roman people apart. So he decided to build the very biggest temple
that had ever been built, not just the largest one in Rome, but the biggest that ever had been built, and to build it to all the gods. So what pantheon means, pan means all, theon, like theology, means God. So the pantheon is a temple to all the gods. So everyone, whether you're interested in Zeus or Diana or Hermes or Neptune or whoever, you could worship in this temple. And he built, as we talked about, we looked at the pantheon when we were looking at dome structures and this incredible 140-foot diameter dome, which is unheard of at the time, and this enormous space on the inside. It was meant to be about unification, about taking all of these different gods, pulling them together, and unifying Rome once again. And in fact, was very, very successful at that. Now, in Thomas Jefferson's time, he saw one of the real problems of America was that it was these 13 colonies, and they were always carping at each other. And Virginia and New York were the ones that were carping at each other the very most. And the rivalry between Alexander Hamilton, who was the big dog in New York, and Thomas Jefferson, who was the big dog in Virginia, there were rivalries happening here. And each state had its own interests and its own competitiveness with other states. And Jefferson, after being president, said, you know, this is a bad thing. We need to all come together. So the unification that was symbolized by the pantheon was reiterated as a unification of our different sectors in the democracy of the United States and pulling them together in the act of this new campus. So one thing is saying we're a republic like Rome. Another thing is saying we're unified as a country. A third message that came by making that analogy of the pantheon is in a more urban sense. So this is the pantheon on the left. And in front of the pantheon originally was a very large stoa. And this would have been like a marketplace. And around the edge of the marketplace, there would be stalls where people would be selling goods. And then this would have been a major market square. And in the center of that square would have been where big ideas were discussed. They would have debates. They would have speeches. It's a very big thing in Roman culture, these speech making. And that's where it happened, right in front of the pantheon, right on the steps of the pantheon. And so, likewise, what a university should be is that place of intellectual dialogue, where people are talking with each other about political issues, about social issues, about things they care about, and there should be this open dialogue. That's what a university should be. So, Thomas Jefferson puts in front of his pantheon, he puts what's now called the lawn, but it is a large open space where the whole community comes together and where there can be that kind of dialogue. So the fourth and final thing is that this was meant to be long-lasting. I mean, this is a brand new institution. There is no such thing as public universities. And there were some people who were skeptical. This is not going to last. That's not important. Only the rich people should be sending their kids to school anyway. How ridiculous to think that women might go to a university. That's crazy. It should only be sons of wealthy landowners. So there were people who were skeptical about this. And Thomas Jefferson wanted to say, no, this is going to last. This is permanent. And so harking it back to this building that had been around for all these centuries and was this permanent vessel, that was an important message as well. So he's saying, what kind of university are we building? We're building one that is about representative government. We're building one that is about longevity. It's here to stay. We're building one that is about the unification of people, not the separation of people, and this respectful dialogue that goes on between them. And he's using literal indirect communication. He's making people think of the pantheon, but think of those characteristics of the pantheon that he wants to transfer to University of Virginia. So he makes the library in the rotunda of the pantheon building. Again, maybe even sort of like the religion, the temple of the university is the place where the books are. It's the learning that is the sacred thing here. And then around the edges, there are these arcades. And the pavilion buildings there one for each discipline. So there's a mathematics building, and there's a building for literature, and there's a building for science, and there's a building for music. And the faculty member that leads that discipline lives with their family on the second floor of that building. And then on the bottom floor are the classrooms and the places for instruction. And then along the arcade between those buildings are the students' rooms. And still to this day, it is a huge honor to be selected to live on the lawn when you're a senior at University of Virginia, in those same student rooms that have been consistently occupied by students since way back in the early part of the 19th century. But it is making what he called an academical village of professors and students and books and learning and dialogue. And all of that is being conveyed very literally in the campus, literally a place for mathematics, literally a place for history. But indirect communication, meant to make you think of other things, of Rome, of democracy, of unification, and so on. Very powerful devices for establishing what public education is in the United States. And the interesting thing is this campus was actually been emulated over and over and over again all over the country. The Columbia campus has its own kind of version of the Pantheon. MIT, where I went to school, has its own kind of version of the Pantheon in its main building. Stanford has its own version of the Pantheon in its main building. Even that sort of diagram of the library at the head and then the pavilions that go down a central space for dialogue in between, like freaking look out the door here. It's right here at University of Texas campus as well. So this has had big meaning for public education in the United States. Literal indirect communication. So let's look at another example of literal indirect communication. This is a fundamental way we talk about architecture. And there are many, many building types where we know that that's a church. Maybe we even know that that's a Catholic church because it's got certain messages that we're accustomed to associating with Catholic churches. Or we look at something and say, oh, that's a school. How do we know that's a school? Well, there are implicit messages that convey the nature of that as a school or as an industrial facility or as a restaurant or whatever. These are conventions of building types. And we're going to look at one of those building types. We could look at any number of them today. But we're going to look in particular at town halls. So when a municipality gets to have a certain presence of itself, and they decide they're going to have a government there, and they house their government in something, how do they give messages that says, this is our town hall, this is the center of our city? And I'm going to use an example at the beginning here of one of the very first town halls that existed anywhere, which is the Doge's Palace in Venice, built in the 14th and 15th century. So this was the government here was like city states. It wasn't like a federal government or a state government. It was all cities were the primary vessel of government. The Doge was like the mayor or the head of city government. And so the place where this mayor lived was the Doge's palace. And Venice would have been an incredibly powerful city at this point, mercantile city, kind of queen of the Mediterranean. And So right here on the water, they would have built the Doge's Palace. And it is, in a way, the town hall of Venice. And I'm saying there are five characteristics that they built into that town hall that then began to inspire other town halls through history. One of those was they put right next to the Doge's Palace, which is this building right here. Right next to it, they put this tower. That's the Tor San Marco. And that marked the center of the city. So very important that they made a tower that marked the center of the city, and that becomes associated with the town hall. So one characteristic is a tower. The second thing they did was they made these focal balconies. So places like right here, that focal balcony, here where the flags are, those focal balconies. And they're a place where literally a decision would be made about the government, about the governance of the people, made inside the building. The Doge would go out on the balcony. The citizens would be gathered in the piazzetta below, and he'd make an announcement. And so as a way of communicating, it was giving a setting for this communication between the governance inside and the people outside. And that became an emblem that was part of making a town hall. A third characteristic is the arcade. And around the Doge's palace, you can see all along the bottom this open arcade at two levels. And this is a way that the people, the citizens, can be kind of inside the building without being in the secure part of the building. So it's saying that this is a public building. It's for the people, and they can claim the edge of the building. And that's what those arcades become on two levels of the Doge's palace. The fourth characteristic is that there's a courtyard in the center of the building. Actually, it's like a donut. And that courtyard is a place where a subset of the citizenry, a representative group, could come in and they could communicate with the leaders, the officials, in that courtyard. So the courtyard was an important part of the emblem of the town hall as well. And then the fifth and final thing was the stair. And the stair was simply a way of elevating certain activities and saying, they're important. You know, this is a place of prestige. This is a place of importance. Elevated things. And the stairs were an emblem of that. So in the Doge's palace, it's telling the people, with a tower, this is the center of the city. And telling people with the focal balcony, there's authority here. And it disseminates messages to the rest of the populace. And telling them with the arcade that it's the people's building. It's permeable. It can be engaged with the public. And by the courtyard, saying that there are a subset of the people that can more actively engage with that. And telling by the stair that this is an elevated function. So all of those messages are there in the Doge's palace. And then as we see town halls through history, after that, we see those same five elements pop up over and over again. So this is the Campidoglio in Rome by Michelangelo. And this would have been done 100 years or so after the Doge's palace. And the Campidoglio is the town hall for Rome. It sits on the top of a hill. That hill is very prominent in the city. But it's not enough. They still have a tower on top of that building. And from all over Rome, you can see this tower. And that tower marks the center of the city and the Campidoglio right there. And as you walk up or you move up to the building from any direction, that tower is kind of the focal element. There also are stairs because it's on this hill. All of it's made these grand stairs that go up there, and you get the sense, again, of it being an elevated function that's up there. There are arcades on the buildings on either side of the Campidoglio, these deep, deep arcades in these buildings designed by Michelangelo, kind of giant orders here of the columns, and then these big, grand arcades that, again, allow people to penetrate and say this is a participatory kind of building. There is that focal balcony right as the stairs climb up here, right in the center, right there, is a place for the leaders of Rome to come out and give a pronouncement to the people down below. So the focal balcony is there. And likewise, the whole thing is built around a courtyard. The three buildings flanking on either side, this courtyard in the very center. So it's got exactly those same characteristics. And again, it's literal indirect communication. I know this is a town hall because it has these characteristics that town halls have. It has a tower. It has a focal balcony. It has a stair. It has a courtyard. It has all of an arcade, these elements we're talking about. And that goes on through centuries. This in the 20th century, city of Stockholm began to build a new town hall. The architect was Ragnar Östberg, and this one was pride and joy of Stockholm. They had a beautiful site on the archipelago in Stockholm, great vistas across the water to the town hall. And the same elements there again.
telling us this is a town hall. The tower marking it as the center of town. Now these little kind of truncated focal balconies right here, you can see it right there. And now they don't really need anybody to walk out and make a pronouncement. We're in the 1920s, they got radio and their newspapers, their ways to communicate that are not about some guy standing on a balcony. But there still is the emblem of that that's built into the town hall. There also are these courtyards and stairs, as we've seen in the other ones. There's both an exterior courtyard like this, and because we're in a Nordic climate and it's freezing cold, there's actually an interior courtyard for people to gather in the same way they might in an outdoor courtyard in Italy, but in a northern climate, it needs to be a little more weather protected. So the courtyard element is there, and then also this incredible arcade in this case, where basically the whole underside of the building is open, going down into that courtyard, and again, that permeability and allowing the public to come right into the building and engage with it. So we know this is a town hall. It tells us it's a town hall by having all these emblems that are associated with town halls. And it doesn't matter what the architectural style is. It can come in any flavor you want. This brutalist building from the 1960s in Boston is the town hall for Boston, Boston City Hall. But it has really those same elements. The focal balcony, in the one case of this one on the right, that's the mayor's office that's being depicted there. On another side of the building, this focal balcony is the council chamber right there, so that we see those emblems. Again, we're not talking about somebody walking out on a balcony, because now we got TV and we got satellite communication, but there needs to be that emblem of authority communicating with the people. The whole building is kind of lifted up and we see that penetrability at the bottom. The arcade now in a kind of super scale at the bottom of the building. There's a courtyard in the center of the building. It's a donut again, just like we saw in the Doge's Palace. And there's stairs throughout, long, grand stairs that take you up to that courtyard. You walk in the front lobby, huge stair that takes you up to the second floor, to the council chamber, to the mayor's office. All of these things that now we just see as implicit in buildings that talk about authority, about governance, all of those things that make it a town hall. So literal indirect communication, very, very common way of carrying messages in architecture. That final method that I mentioned is abstract communication. And this, again, is one that's very commonly used in architecture, very powerful. This one is a church in San Francisco, St. Mary's Cathedral. This was done by the Catholic Church in the 1970s. And there had been a big kind of upheaval in the Catholic Church about how they would build buildings and how they would conduct their services. And one of the things that was very different here was the idea that maybe we shouldn't have this long nave and the altar way at the end down there. That alienates the audience. And instead, they decided they wanted to have the audience more around the altar. So that made a different shape of a church. Also, they wanted very much to depict themselves as being modern and progressive and contemporary, not something that's just historicist or for old people or old ways of thinking. So they built this cathedral very, very modern and kind of abstract. But there's no doubt that this is a cathedral. And there's no doubt that it's about religion. And it carries those messages really powerfully and palpably in the building. So it's reaching to the heavens, and we get the sense it's not a freaking office building. It's not a school. It's not an industrial facility. It's something that's aspiring and spiritual, emotional. The curvilinear shapes, these are abstract ways of communicating something about its religious function. Inside, it's very dark within these stained glass up in the top, and this colored, shimmery light
that falls down in it, very emotional, very spiritual. No doubt that this interior is about putting you not in a disciplined, rational state of mind, but in a spiritual, emotional state of mind. But it's doing it through abstract means, by color, by texture, by light quality. There's a beautiful piece of sculpture that hangs in the center. You can see it in the slide on the right. It's made of thousands and thousands of little stainless steel, shiny pieces. And the way the light catches it and the color catches it, it just shimmers there, almost angelic, you know, very, very spiritual feeling. But again, in an abstract level, not saying, you know, here's the Madonna, that's literal communication, or here's Christ on a cross, or, you know, here is a bell tower, or here's a campanile. This instead is more abstract ways of communicating what religion might mean in the last part of the 20th century. Similar challenge would have come with the architect designing the LBJ Library in the 1970s. So this the architect for SOM was a guy named Gordon Bunshaft. And presidential libraries were a brand new thing. In fact, there were no purpose-built buildings for presidential libraries at this point. JFK, there was clearly a goal to build a presidential library for him, but they'd kind of been slow doing it and had to change sites, and so it hadn't been built yet. And LBJ's library was kind of the first big presidential library. So what do we want to say in the presidential library? It's not like a town hall where we've got this established vocabulary. So they're using abstract communication, something about the scale of it, that lets us know this is, you know, an important event on the campus and in the city. Maybe even things, and I don't know, go out there and look at the LBJ Library. Or better yet, go inside the LBJ Library. And I think it says a lot about the presidency, this powerful institution. I think it says a lot about LBJ. Maybe not just power, but I don't know, maybe heavy-handed power. I mean, this could be a mausoleum in Egypt. It's like for a pharaoh. This is not just power. This is kind of huge authority. And maybe this is sort of like LBJ. I mean, this was a powerful guy, LBJ. This was no timid president. He was a man who knew how to rather ruthlessly get things done. And the building conveys something like that about LBJ. So I think in abstract ways, by its scale, by its color, by its materials made of this very beautiful travertine, precious material brought from Italy, you know, by this inside, this huge space, this great hall at the end of it, with all the red boxes with his archives in there, the acoustics even of it, very reverberant. All of those things are meant to tell you something in an abstract way about the presidency and about LBJ. One building that is a really beautiful exemplification of abstract communication is this relatively recent museum in Berlin dedicated to Jewish culture in Germany. And this was a very difficult challenge again to do. Obviously, there's a difficult history of Judaism in Germany. The Nazis and the Holocaust and all of that, these are difficult things to talk about. So this is not something that's easy for us to communicate about these things. They had a big competition to select an architect for this, and they ended up selecting Daniel Libeskind. Libeskind's family were Holocaust survivors. His family was from Poland, and all of his immediate family had fled from Poland. A large number of his family were actually killed in the Holocaust. They fled to Israel in 1945, the survivors. He was born in Israel in 1948, and then his family immigrated to the United States. So this was someone who had very deep feelings about Judaism and about the Holocaust and about that whole German enterprise. And he designed a building that, in an abstract way, communicates the difficulty of Jews in Germany, a kind of austere, hard, cold building. It's not meant to be beautiful. It's not meant to be soft. It's not meant to be pretty at all. It's, in fact, supposed to be a little disturbing. This is what they call the garden of the Holocaust Museum, with these concrete piers. It's 7 piers by 7 piers. Each of the piers is filled with dirt, and on the top of it is an oak tree. And you go down in this labyrinth down below, and you, for one thing, it's all tilted, so it's out of kilter. And then in this labyrinth, you can never tell when somebody's coming in the other direction, and so you're constantly kind of bumping into people. Everything's uncertain. And that's meant in an abstract way to tell you what it would be like to be a Jew in Germany. You never know when everything's going to be pulled out from under you. You never know who to trust, how to anticipate, what's happening. Everything's a little out of kilter in their world. The main museum building itself is this very gray metal material. The openings in it are like slashes, like violent eruptions in the facade of the building. It has some recollections of the death camps in Nazi Germany, which were very dour, gray, industrial kinds of facilities. There is this disorientation, which is like the diaspora of Jews in Germany, where they were constantly being moved from one community to another. They would be put in a ghetto, and then they would take that ghetto away from them and move them to another community. And that was over centuries. They had this history, not just in the Holocaust. So the building is meant to have that instability, that kind of disruption. Even inside, all the beams and columns don't align. They're very erratic. And what windows exist there are very strange and kind of slice through the building in a violent way. This building was built after the competition, but they had such a hard time deciding what the content of the exhibits would be that there simply it didn't have any exhibits for about 5 years. And you could make an appointment, you could go to see the building, and it was just a museum with no exhibits, just the building. And there were many people who, after it had been in operation a couple of years, said, "Don't put any exhibits in here." It gives the message all by itself. It tells you in a very powerful way what it was like to be a Jew in Germany. The uncertainty, the instability. There's one moment in it where you go down a long, 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 long hall, and at the end of it is just one room, and the room is a tower, a very, very tall tower. You go in that door, and they shut the door behind you. And you're left alone in this trapezoidal room that's incredibly tall and just has one little dose of light in it. And you can feel a kind of scary aloneness in that room that's meant to let you know what it's like to be alone in a culture that doesn't accept you, that doesn't want you, where you're alienated. There's another space that is extremely reverberant, all very hard surfaces, very big kind of cathedral-like space. And you're meant to walk across this space. But on the floor, there are all these discs of metal. And when you walk on the discs of metal, they all scrape against each other and make that awful sound that metal makes when it scrapes on metal. And each one of those discs has like a face on it, but it's a screaming face. So as you walk across these, you're making these horrible screaming noises. And you're seeing all these faces, and pretty much everybody turns back and can't walk across there. Although that's the, you know, that's the direct path to where you're going. You walk out there, you can't stand it. And you go back and have to take the long way around. But this is using acoustics, using shape, using space, using light, using materials to convey in a very abstract but palpable way what the experience was like to be a Jew in Germany. Okay, Twitter card question for today. I want you to think of some place, again, from your hometown, from the campus, from Austin, some place that communicates a message to you, a building or a place that communicates a message to you. What is the message? What is the place? What is the message? And how does it convey that?